We'll open a public hearing first on House Bill 3057 and ask Elizabeth to bring us up to date.
Okay, Mr. Chairman and committee members, this House Bill 3057, again, there are no new amendments or anything to this bill, but what the bill is doing is allowing land within boundaries of cities or urban growth areas to be designated as riparian land and partially property tax exempt if cities or counties adopt ordinances that are permitting the designation. So the partial property tax exemption is for the property taxes of the city and the county district only. It applies to tax years beginning on or after July 1st, 2002. So after the last meeting, there was some discussion about some of the aspects as far as implementation with the Department of Fish and Wildlife. So I think they're to be here today. Yes, I see a nod, so yes.
Okay.
And so they'll deal with some of the fiscal aspects of it. And basically with the revenue aspect, it will be a reduction in city and county local revenues, but it's just for those governing bodies that are adopting by ordinance this partial property tax exemption. The revenue impact is obviously uncertain, as it does depend on the number of landowners in the cities and within urban areas who choose to designate a portion of their land, which is riparian. I think the important thing to remember here, though, is if a city does adopt an ordinance that is proving a property tax exemption, you're going to have to give a property tax exemption to all the landowners who are going to be applying then to the Department of Fish and Wildlife for this particular designation as riparian land. So it is up to the Department of Fish and Wildlife to establish rules then that they would need in order to carry out this particular program, and it would be, you would be relying on the same statutes as what we have under current law for riparian land.
Okay. Is that it?
Yes.
Thank you very much. Note the members we're having distributed to us, a letter from Salem Mayor Mike Swaim, the hero of Salem. urging support for House Bill 3057. Just make a note of that for the record. Let me bring up Susan Schneider and Mary Stevens. And Ms. Nelson Kent. Is she here? Oh, yes. Do you want to come on up, too? We'll fill up the table. I understand you signed up separately, but. Please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Susan Schneider with the City of Portland. With me is Mary Stevens with the City's Bureau of Environmental Services. Basically, we're just here to answer any questions you have about the bill and to ask you to support it. I would like to make one clarification, and that is that the bill provides at line 9 that the governing bodies of the city and the county, which land is located, both have adopted ordinances or resolutions permitting the designation of the land as riparian land. And in those ordinances, it is the intent to allow the city or the and county to agree on how much land they can handle at a time in that. So you might bring in a certain amount each year. But as the staff indicated, it is indeterminate how much that would be. So we can't give you a percentage of.
So your intent then under Section 2, Sub 1A is that the ordinance that a governing body adopts can designate less than all of the corporate limits of that jurisdiction for the purposes of these riparian zones?
Yes, Mr. Chair. It might be by miles. It might be by assessed value.
Okay. Ms. Stevens?
I think Susan pretty well summed up, you know, we're just here to answer questions.
Are there any questions from committee members? I think we wanted to take some time on this last time we heard it, not because of any concern particularly, but just because we wanted to spend a little time puzzling it through. And yeah, Representative Hass.
Well, I agree with what you just said. It's not that I oppose it. I just am curious how this will work in real life. Once a riparian zone is created, then what responsibility or obligations does a landowner have? Then?
Okay, let's bring up ODF&W.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, My name is Roy Elker, legislative coordinator for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, and here with Ms. Patty Snow from Habitat Division, here to address specific questions from the committee. I did have some general testimony, however, I think that was passed out last time. Is that correct?
Wait a minute.
Yep.
It was, okay.
Thank you.
Okay.
Anyway, wanted to just make a few key points here, that right, first of all, right now we have 23 out of 36 counties participating in the program for a total of about 113 landowners, and I'll let Ms. Snow talk about more particulars about that and about how the program actually works. The department's very supportive of the program, but however, there is a cost to the department if this program is expanded, and I thought you might be given a fiscal today through legislative fiscal, since we filed something earlier today on this issue. But expansion of the program would probably mean some additional resources for the department being put into the program, since we do have to do the technical assistance for landowners, and we figure that at about 2 to 3 FTEs.
I don't have a fiscal. Do you have a fiscal?
Mr. Chairman, no, we didn't get a fiscal yet.
Okay.
That's a fiscal one, I thought.
That's a revenue.
I think it's the preliminary one.
Oh.
Yeah, this is one where.
What are you doing, sir?
Date is April 2nd.
Oh, go back. Oh, okay, the last.
I corrected the phone errors.
Mr. Chair, the fiscal that we were, that I was discussing would have been dated today, as I understand, since the discussion this morning between our economist, and LFO. I was hoping that you would have that here today.
Elizabeth, what are you looking at in the way? You've got something that's
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, what I have is, I'm sure, what you all discussed, but that there be an addition of 3 FTEs for a looks like a total amount of about $263,994 in the 2001-03 biennium and $333,492 in the 2003-05 biennium.
Chairman, do we have this?
We don't.
No,
we do not. It says they just got it to LFO today, and Elizabeth is looking at a, is that, do you want to make copies of that for everybody?
Okay, make copies. I can't believe that they're going to take 3 new FTEs to administer this program. That's absolutely absurd.
Okay, well, Mr. Chairman, you want me to read
let's get a copy.
Okay, I'll just copy it.
Yeah, we'll keep the discussion going while the copies are being made. Susan, do you want to come up for a second? Will you... You just didn't screw the chair up there. Had you been involved? Easier said than done, perhaps. Oh, gee.
People go around and make sure.
Had you been involved in fiscal impact discussions?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, no. We had a brief discussion yesterday. I didn't hear anything about VFTE.
Okay. Mr. Elker, again, I guess if you could fill us in on where these 3 FTEs come from. What they're going to be doing?
Well, let me defer here to Ms. Snow to talk about, because in a sense, we do work with landowners to implement the program. The landowners just don't send us a plan for a riparian zone and we say okay and file it. We go on site and we work with landowners to develop a riparian plan, make sure the riparian zone's in good riparian condition, good condition for wildlife, water functions, and whatever. And that's, if we're going to go statewide here, and if we're going to really open the program up to allow, especially urban growth boundary folks, which in some counties will be quite a workload, as number of landowners per county as you see now, it will mean some additional resources for the department to be able to assist landowners in getting riparian zone designation.
Ms. Snow?
Chair,
could you pull a microphone there? Thanks.
This program has been
in effect
for the record, I'm Patricia Snow. I'm the Land Use Coordinator in the Habitat Division of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. And the Riparian Tax Incentive Program has been in effect for over 20 years now. But as you probably know, it's been limited to areas that are zoned for agricultural or forest and outside urban growth boundaries. So we've had some participation, but it's been fairly limited because those resource lands already have fairly low taxes, so there hasn't been a huge run on our tax incentive program up until now. What typically happens is the landowner approaches one of our field biologists out in the field, and they work with the landowner to develop a riparian management plan and agreement specifying what sort of activities they will or won't do on the riparian area. And then our folks also go out and periodically monitor it. That's actually, they haven't done that so much in the past, but we revised our rules recently to say that we will go out and look at these sites periodically to make sure that the plans are being implemented. Up until now, as I mentioned, we've only been dealing with agriculture and forest zones, which tend to be fairly large lots. So we're, for each stream mile that we work with, we're only dealing with, you know, a fairly limited number of property owners. We're anticipating as we get into urban areas that we'll have quite a few more property owners that we're dealing with because the lots are fairly small. So, again, the fiscal impact would come from our biologists helping the landowners develop the plans. In some cases, not all cases, the property owners could do that themselves or hire a wildlife consultant, for example, but our folks do need to go out on the site to look at the land, make sure the plans make sense biologically, and then approve them. And happy to answer any questions.
Questions for Ms. Snow, yes, Representative Hass.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What happens if someone doesn't want to play, they're in this zone and they say, I'm not interested, or if someone says, I'll do it, I want the exemption, and then they don't comply with the necessary requirements?
Representative Hess, first, it's a voluntary program. People don't have to participate in it. If they do elect to participate, ultimately they can withdraw from it, or if the property is sold, the new property owner has a choice whether they want to maintain that participation in the program or not. And I believe we have two incentive programs, and I need to refresh my memory. I believe that they do have a penalty if they withdraw. We would look back at the property. We would review to see if they weren't implemented. For example, let's say they were going to keep riparian vegetation within 50 feet and the landowner had not done that, then we would also notify the tax assessor that they were not qualifying for the tax exemption anymore. But again, it is a very—it's a completely voluntary program. Property owners don't have to participate if they don't want to. They typically approach us.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Bates, and then Beck.
I think it's a good bill and one that would go a long ways in restoring stream habitat, as some of the streams inside our city are the hardest hit. I'm just wondering if ODF is the right way to go, or ODF FW, I guess. I'm sorry. I mean, as an example, in Ashland, we have a stream running through the town called, that is running through the center of town, which occasionally floods us out, but for the most part, it's a nice stream, and it's maintained the Parks and Recreation Department with a fine riparian area. I'm wondering if this shouldn't be a responsibility of the cities, not the state, to do this. I'm not sure that that in an urban setting you have the expertise or have had experience doing this. Well, I think the cities may well be in a better position to do this. Plus, they're the ones that are giving exemption to taxes. And it wouldn't require more FTEs to do it, I wouldn't think. They could go for personnel they have in place.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, that's an excellent idea, sir, and please don't. This fiscal impact is the department's taking a hard look here and not wanting to get into the situation where there's a demand for our services and not being able to provide the help that a lot of landowners would like to have here. From the department standpoint, we definitely don't want to get into that situation. If there is some way that we could work together with cities or parks departments or whatever to facilitate implementing this bill, the department will do just that. If the department, however, is asked, however, to make all these riparian designations and approve them and monitor periodically that landowners are keeping them in proper riparian condition, then there will be a workload, and the department didn't want to come forward and bring that to the attention of the committee.
Representative Beck.
I just wanted to ask the city, this is not, I know that, one, this is discretionary, as I understand it, on part of the cities. Is that correct? too, we don't anticipate this being a huge program in the immediate future. This is going to be something that will be gradually, there takes several years to inform landowners the opportunity to be involved with this, to assume that there's going to be need three bureaucrats at ODFW sitting at Carroll's downtown Portland waiting for the phone to ring from riparian landowners inside urban growth boundaries is absolutely absurd. I mean, I do not anticipate, I'm making a statement, but also a question. Susan, you don't think this is going to be a program that's going to create a huge demand on ODFW anytime soon, do you?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beck, no, we don't. One of the limiting factors on this program is just what cities and counties can afford to give up in terms of property taxes, which is precious little right at the moment. But we did want to begin the program. We're happy to consult with ODFW as we go forward in working out what we can afford and what works in terms of workload and the rest of it. I regret that Representative Bates has given us more credit for expertise than we have probably on staff. We don't typically have either the riparian specialists in terms of plant materials or wildlife biologists on staff. More of us may as things go forward with the ESA, but we certainly don't at the moment. And so we would prefer to rely on their expertise, but we would be happy to work collaboratively with them to figure out what works.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beck, it's not envisioned that these people would be in headquarters. These people would be in the field and be helping landowners in the field. Just wanted to clarify that point. Thank you.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
But my understanding, Roy, is that these will be staff who have to review these management plans. And these are people who will be doing a little bit of both. I mean, they're going to have an office. They're going to be filing paperwork, meeting with landowners to figure out what a good management plan is. These aren't just field biologists out in their waders along the Willamette River, right? I mean, there is.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beck, I would, once this program got going, we envisioned that these people would be primarily out in the field working with landowners, because it takes a lot of hands-on assistance to help landowners who don't know anything about riparian zones or what kind of shrub should be there or what kind of function should be there. It takes a lot of work on the ground with the landowner. So these people, I assume, once the program gets up and going, would be in their waders at least half the time. I mean, as you look at the S&S, I don't know if you have it in front of you, sir, but mostly it's vehicle costs, computer, things like that. And these people strike me as we have a similar function handled right now by our fish screening coordinators. Three of those are stationed around the state, and all they do is assist landowners on site with irrigation diversions and other fish screening needs. If this program got up and going, I could see plenty of demand for it within those specific areas. Because, again, I just think with the cost of the price of property taxes and real estate within the urban growth boundary, I think this program might become popular, and there will be quite a demand on services. And that's just what we're trying to get a sense of here and put it out there.
Representative Carlson? Then we'll come back to Susan. Go ahead.
Okay. I just was curious how many projects you have outside the urban growth boundary right now that you manage?
There's 113 property owners, Representative Carlson, that are participating in the program at this point in time.
Okay, and then can I follow up? And then how many projects were you estimating might happen in the first?
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, that was the point I wanted to get to. Thank you. Is that we would expect that most of the effort would be in restoration in an urban area. There aren't a lot of areas you could just go out and would qualify. And that if in the Portland area, if we got 2 miles a year, that would be absolutely extraordinary.
Pardon, I was trying to listen to two conversations, but how many?
2 miles in a year would be really extraordinary.
2 miles? Okay. So how many, I guess it follows with me. How many property owners would that be? So I can have an apples and apples kind of comparison.
perhaps 6 to 8, Representative Carlson?
6 to 8 property owners.
That would be the high side.
And one more question for Fish and Wildlife. How many FTE do you have managing 113 right now?
Representative Carlson, at this point, we don't have anybody who's solely designated to this program. It's biologists that are doing this as part of their other duties. Wildlife biologists, habitat biologists. There isn't any one person that does this full time.
And well, just what portion of their FTE would you say they've been doing this work?
Well, let's see, because all the different counties, we have pieces of different people around the state. I guess, I'm just guessing now with our other Habitat Incentive Program, maybe 15% of a number of different people would be my guess. We can supply that information.
Okay.
If we ask the folks who deal with these programs to estimate the amount of time they spend on the programs.
Representative Carlson, we could provide that by end of the day today. We just pulled this together this morning, and so we didn't have all the information. So if you'd like some further information, we can get that to you by end of the day on that issue. Exactly what FTE is working on these right now.
That would be helpful.
Okay.
Chair Carlson, Susan Schneider, I would just like to add that I think that one of the things, I know one of the things we could do working collaboratively with, it's not in our interest, first of all, to have ODFW not be able to handle this work because it doesn't achieve the goal that we're trying to get to, which is restoration of the habitat. So one of the things we can certainly do in the context of the ordinance is target large pieces, if that helps, large property, if that helps, to offer that first or to offer that in combination with some. And, I mean, there are a lot of ways to design it to make it workable, I would think, with them. I just wish we could have had this conversation earlier.
Other questions, comments?
I have a comment.
Representative Beck.
Well, I think this is, I can't imagine this is going to have a major fiscal impact anytime soon. I do think that ODFW has an agency much in need of more resources to do the job that the public and the federal government are asking them to do. And I think programs like this will continue to help make the case. If some model projects get done in cities where people live or in an impact of a large constituency, it will make it a lot easier to come back here next session and successive sessions when you have a small handful of these riparian zone projects in place and you can understand what the process is and you have a constituency built around them. I think it will be a lot easier to make the case to get legislative support for more positions to help administer and expand this type of program. If we wait until we get the legislature to staff up for a prospective program, legislature will never do it. And you won't have a constituency down here of citizens, not just City of Portland's and metros, but you won't have citizens down here begging for more. I think that this is sort of program that would be in ODFW's interest to get going. It's not going to be a huge burden in the next 2 to 3 years. There are not going to be people clamoring to get these plans together. They're not going to know about it for a long time. But I think the long-term benefit to the agency in building a constituency for riparian area protection in cities will be enhanced if few projects are completed and discussed in the community and in the next legislature and so forth. So I would urge the agency to think long term and not get mired down in these sort of speculative fiscal impacts that I don't think are going to materialize anytime soon. So I think we should move this bill out and get it going today.
Madam Chair?
Representative Bates.
I'd ask you also to think about some innovative things that can be done. When I think of riparian habitat repair, especially in cities, I think of volunteer groups that have done a huge amount of work, and you're aware of them. Trout Unlimited, Northwood Steelers, even some of the extension agents like OSU have helped us in those situations in the past. And this fiscal impact could kill this bill. I think it's a good bill. We need to move it forward. And I have a hard time believing we're going to have any significant impact the next couple of years. That would give you time to look at some innovative and ways to approach this that may not have much of an impact. I can imagine Northwest Steelers get on board in something like this for the Portland area real quick and get those steelhead up the stream, up their spawning beds through the cities. I mean, I've seen it in action. We still have, we have steelhead coming up through the city parks in action to their spawning beds. And that happens because we take good care of that stream. And there's not much financial impact for state, city, or county government to do that. I hate to see this thing go away because of this. Thank you.
I just wanted to add, I believe this, the copy that we have is the agency's mm-hmm. information that then goes to our legislative fiscal office, and I'm not sure if they've had a chance to, since we don't have the statement here from them, they may analyze this and actually talk with you. Have you had a meeting with them since you sent this to them today, or have not? And I was doing a little bit of penciling, and it's about $70,000 per position. So if you got a half a position, it would be about $35,000, which would be under the $50,000 threshold. I'm thinking 68 properties might merit half a position. That'd be more the direction I think I'd be looking at. Anyway, we have one more person, Heather Nelson Kent. The Metro has not had an opportunity to testify. So.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. Heather Nelson Kent. I'm here on behalf of the Metro Regional Government, the Metro Council, today, just to support this bill. We've been looking for opportunities for new incentives for landowners to take some of the responsibility for repairing and restoring habitat areas in the metro area, and I think this is a good step in the right direction. And I think Representative Beck had a good point that I'm not sure it will take off immediately, but it'll be great to have another tool to provide to local landowners so that they can take the responsibility for doing the right thing for fish and wildlife. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Just as a follow-up to the discussion, the 6 to 8 properties, that probably was in the Portland area that you were thinking of, right? Because that's the area in Metro. Is that in the ballpark from what you were thinking of?
Yes, I would agree with that estimate.
Thank you. Thank you. Anyone else that didn't sign up that would like to testify on House Bill 3057? I've been instructed to wait until our chair gets back to go into work session, so we're going to, and I don't have a gavel, so we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3057. Thank you. And how about opening a public hearing? Is there a preference on hitting? Do you have another one of these?
Nope.
Okay. Just perhaps, how about 2280? Until I have no idea what it is we're doing today. But there's some amendments. Is there anyone here to testify? This is a work session?
No, they're
closed. Okay.
I think you've already heard Jesus and Bill's and Leaders and Bears.
Well, he told me not to go to work session on anything until I got back.
Yeah, they're both.
Okay. Was there anyone signed up on today?
I just read the other off.
Okay. So maybe you can just bring us up to date and. That's the one that has nobody. So, Ed, would you bring us up to date on what's going on with 2280? I opened it on 2280. Over here.
Excuse me, Madam Chair. House Bill 2280 extends the long-term care insurance credit to cover policies issued prior to January 1, 2000. Current law, which was passed in the 1999 session, provides the credit only for policies issued on or after January 1, 2000. We have some -1 amendments which have been analyzed and correspond to the revenue impact statement, which should be in the packet with the bill. And what they do are they delay the applicability until the 2003 tax year. So the first tax year that the changes to the credit would apply would be 2003. Sets the credit for old policies, that is policies issued prior to January 1, 2000, at 10% of the premiums
paid for tax years 2003 and 2004. And then in tax year 2005, it increases that credit to 15% of the premiums issued, so that it would equate with the credit currently allowed for policies issued after January 1, 2000. In any case, the maximum credit is $500 per taxpayer or per covered employee in the case of an employer providing long-term care insurance for employees or employees' dependents.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? There's no one signed up to testify, so.
Madam Chair, we had a bill last session. I don't exactly remember the bill number, but it was a bill that provided a credit of up to 15% of the premium for a long-term care policy, up to a maximum of $500 per year. The bill came to the Revenue Committee, and last session it passed in the committee. It passed overwhelmingly on the House floor. I think there was maybe one or two votes opposing it. And then the bill went to the Senate, and the bill was amended significantly in the Senate so that the credit only applied to new policies.
Mm.
It did not apply to any policies that were in effect as of January 1, 2000. Mm. And the reason the bill was amended in the Senate was primarily because of the revenue impact from the bill when you included all the policies. The bill came back to the House, and we concurred in the Senate amendments, and the governor signed the bill. During the interim, I had lots of calls from folks all around the state, because I kind of got identified with the bill because I carried it on the House floor, who complained about the discriminatory treatment. If they had a policy already in effect for long-term care insurance, they were denied this credit for their premiums. It's only folks who bought a insurance policy, a long-term care insurance policy, after January 1, 2000 that got the credit. So what I've looked at this session is I brought this bill and I brought the Dash 1 amendments to try to phase in the fiscal impact. But the twofold intention of this bill, number one, is to end the current discriminatory treatment that we have relative to the tax treatment of long-term care insurance policies. And then number two, which was the purpose of the 99 legislation as well, was to provide some additional support and incentive for people to buy long-term care insurance. Because when they own long-term care insurance, it puts them in a position where the insurance will assist them in terms of their needs when they require long-term care instead of being going to Medicaid and being dependent upon Medicaid for that support. So what I did here is as Ed pointed out, number one, I lowered the amount of the credit 10% starting in the 2003-2004 period of time, and then up to 15% starting in 2005. So that we can kind of phase in the impact of this. And, of course, there's no impact, as you can see, in the coming biennium. So it would phase in the 03-05 and 05-07 biennium. And then it would end the discriminatory treatment and, I think, fulfill the policy that the legislature was trying to fulfill in 99, which is to create some support and some incentive for people to buy long-term care insurance. Because over the long run, I think the belief is that that actually saves money, and it gives people an assistance in terms of doing what's right relative in terms of providing for their needs as they get older.
Ma'am.
Thank you. Represent
that. This is to Representative Witt. I guess I don't remember having a hearing. I assume we had a hearing on this, or did we just do a CAF hearing?
I'm not sure.
I don't have anything in the file, but.
Well, I remember it was in Human Resources because I was staffing that
committee. Okay. Well, I'm just kind of curious as to the policy of long-term care insurance. Who would buy long-term care insurance today? I don't know anything about it, really.
Yeah, I think generally, I'm not an expert on this, Representative, but I think generally people, as they are getting older, start considering the benefits the long-term care insurance would provide to them. And
so if you're 60 years old and you start purchasing long-term care insurance, and when you're 62 you have a stroke and you need to go into a home and you live for 30 years, are you covered, or do they drop the coverage at some point?
I think generally you're covered. Of course, the younger that you buy the long-term care insurance, the less expensive it is in terms of the annual premium, the younger you are when you buy it.
The younger you are.
The hope, Representative Beck, is that you would start buying long-term care insurance
now
right. And then you would be able to provide for yourself when you got older.
Because, of course, it's much less expensive to buy at the age of 40 than it is to buy at the age of 70.
Right.
And what happens when people don't buy it at a relatively younger age, if they wait until they're in their 70s, of course, it becomes prohibitively expensive. So what a lot of insurance people would tell you is to buy it at maybe 45, 50, 55, 60. And, of course, you'll be paying, probably be paying premiums for a period of time because assuming you won't be getting a benefit, although you might. But if you wait till you're too old, it becomes more and more prohibitive.
Right.
So the purpose, again, the purpose of this bill is just to fulfill the policy objective, I think, the legislature expressed last session, but simply didn't fully enact because of the fiscal impact when we tried to do this all in one bite.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Representative Bates.
A couple of areas of clarification might help out, too. I just went through the process 5 years ago of selecting a long-term health care,
care insurance.
Care insurance for myself, my wife, and you have a broad range of things you can get. Most of them require you have, you lose two activities of daily living. It's rated on how old you are when you get it, of course, just as Representative Wood said. And you have to carry it until you need it, and you may never need it, but that's the only chance you take. And how much, and you also sign up for how much each month you're going to receive if you go to an extended care facility. So it's like any other kind of insurance policy. It's risk versus benefit and what your chances are. And I think more and more people are buying this now, and there are some, I seem to remember there was some tax law at the federal level that, that encouraged you to do that also. And some companies are doing it for their employees. So it's something we're seeing more and more of as we become more aware that we're aging and our population's aging, and in the medical side of it, we're trying to encourage people to do that also. The question I have for LFO, to change up a little bit, you calculated what it would cost the state as far as it's concerned, but there's also another side to it. That's what it saves the state. A lot of these people, if they're not taken care of at home, may well end up in extended care facilities at state expense, because state expense is usually where they end up at. Something like 50 or 60% of the people in those extended care facilities are at the expense. This could be something that could save the state money, too. Is there any way of calculating that at all, or looking at it?
OTIM.
Yeah, OTIM.
OTIM.
I don't know if OTIM is capable of that one.
Yes.
Then it's not worth it.
Well, let me ask you, I'm not sure to be late. I was just championing colorectal cancer and prostate cancer down in the Health and Public Advocacy Committee. The bill we passed last session was prospective. I assume we've covered this. So in this doesn't create an incentive. This basically rewards, isn't that right, people who had policies in effect prior to this date in January last time. Oh, go ahead.
Well, it does both. Number one, of course, you have to pay your premiums every year.
Sure.
So if you started getting long-term care in your early 50s and you stop paying your premiums when you're 58 or 60, I mean, this having the credit available still does create some continuing incentive because you have to make the decision every year to continue to pay the premiums to keep the policy in effect. But over and beyond that, I think the point that I made when you were out of the room was that the bill we passed last session, which was amended in the Senate to only include prospective policies, my understanding is it was done largely, if not solely, because of the revenue impacts of the bill. And I made the point that in the interim, I had lots of calls from people, because I carried the bill on the House floor, I had lots of calls from people that were complaining about the discriminatory treatment. People were saying, in essence, because I already got a long-term care insurance policy back in 1996 and have continued to pay the premiums, I'm being treated less favorably than someone who now just turned around and bought the policy. I think there's two issues here. There's an issue of fairness here relative to tax policy. Are we treating people essentially the same? And there's also the issue, I think, of the incentive, and I think they're both legitimate issues. And there's also the issue, frankly, of making the insurance more affordable. Because I think the rationale, or certainly a significant piece of the rationale for this policy, was that it would make people less dependent upon Medicaid as they get older and they need long-term care, because they will have private insurance in place. So I think there's actually three levels of justification for this bill.
Help me remember then, Representative Whitman. It sounds like you have the answer. When we passed this out of the House, was it retroactive?
Yes, it applied to all policies.
And it was the Senate amendment that made it prospective only?
That is correct.
Okay. Well, I'm on record. Representative Hatt.
Thank you. I think this is a good idea, so we're getting it wrong with this question, Representative Whitman. Some people will still not be able to afford this even with the credit. So therefore, wouldn't you have the situation where this wouldn't help the poorest of the poor, but would reward people who could afford the scheme without a credit.
You know, Representative Hess, I'm not sure what the, again, these policies are going to vary in cost depending upon when you buy it and, I guess, a number of different factors. And I don't know typically what these policies would cost for someone who's 55 or 60, you know, to begin to purchase these policies. Certainly, it seems to me that someone who is relatively modest means in terms of their income, this is a significant help to. I don't know if you can buy these policies for $500 a year, if they're $1,000 a year, but even if they were $1,000 a year, your credit's 15% or $500. I mean, it's an assist, certainly. Does it help the low-income person who basically can't afford the policy? Probably not very much, no. I think that's, you know, that's where you look at, frankly, you look at Medicaid coming in and helping those people. But what it does, I think, is it makes it possible for more middle-income people to afford these policies so that you don't have such a drain on Medicaid 20, 30 years from now when the baby boom generation is needing long-term care, that hopefully you have a lot more than to have private insurance, so it doesn't put such strain on Medicaid, and Medicaid's able to take care of those who truly need the support from government in terms of meeting those needs.
Representative Carlson?
I just want to respond to Representative Hass's question as well. The flip side of that, there's sort of a misnomer that the poorest of the poor will be the ones taking advantage of Medicaid, but what we've been hearing, and Representative Bates can respond as well if he's hearing the same thing, and that is that it's not just the poorest of the poor who are seniors who use Medicaid because the expenses are so high, particularly if you're in a nursing home or have those intensive care services, that it doesn't take long for a middle-class family to essentially ratchet down their resources and impoverish themselves, and then they're on Medicaid. So we're looking at large numbers of the population who are older right now that are using Medicaid resources, which is why the proposed cut in assisted living facility rates has, you know, so gotten everybody so up in arms because so many people are on state assistance for that.
Okay. Well, nobody has signed up to testify on this bill. Anybody in the room just feel inspired? Okay. Let me close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 2280. Representative Witt?
Mr. Chairman, I move the dash one amendments to House Bill 2280.
Representative Witt moves the dash one amendments to House Bill 2280. Is there any discussion? Any objection to the dash one amendments? There are none. They are in. Representative Witt?
Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill 2280 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Witt moves House Bill 2280 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Pretty good for a bill with no testimony. In it's just one of those things that sells itself, I guess. You know, there's another, I think another advantage of this in terms of creating incentive not only to purchase but then to maintain these kinds of policies. We talked about keeping people off of Medicaid. I think that's going to make the program work better for those who truly do need it. And there's an issue, too, of intergenerational wealth transfers. They talked about the middle-class families that spend down their resources to poverty levels and don't have wealth to pass on. In my law practice, I get lots of questions about that, folks who are spending down to the point that what they had, which may have been modest to begin with, but was something, is gone. And then there's nothing left for the next generation, and sometimes that can be a generation that themselves could have used some assistance from that transfer from the parents' generation. So it could have some long-term benefits, I think, for more than just the folks who are paying for these policies. So with that, is there any further discussion? And please call the roll, Joe.
Representative Bates.
Aye.
Bass.
Aye.
Brown.
Aye.
Hass.
Aye.
Williams.
Excused.
Witt.
Aye.
Vice Chair Carlson.
Aye.
Excused, but I know she'd vote yes if she were here. votes aye. House Bill 2280 goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. We need a carrier. I'm going to bet, Representative Witt, you'd like to have that one.
It'll be two sessions in a row, Mr. Chairman.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'll make it 30. I'm lucky,
okay? Okay, we'll open a public hearing then on House Bill 2332. 2332. Okay. That's you again, isn't it?
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2332
creates a personal income tax credit for taxpayers providing unreimbursed assistance to disabled relatives. I believe we did have a public hearing on that. I received quite a bit of testimony back in March 20th. We have some dash one amendments which do a number of things. The first thing they do are to delay the applicability until the 2003 tax year. At that time, it sets the maximum credit equal to $1,000. And effective the 2005 tax year, it increases that maximum credit amount to $1,500. It also reduces the income limits for taxpayers qualifying for the credit. The dash one amendments set the taxable income threshold at $40,000. So taxpayers above $40,000 federal taxable income would not be eligible for the full credit, although there is a pretty rapid phase out for incomes between $40,000 and $42,000. Also, the dash one amendments index that $40,000 income threshold to inflation beginning with the 2004 tax year. Credit is non-refundable and no carry forward.
Okay. Representative Witt, did you want to speak to the dash one amendments? We're in public hearing.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. We heard this bill, as Ed said, I think 6 weeks ago or so, and there was quite a bit of testimony in support of it, including from the Alzheimer's Association, a variety of organizations that represent individuals that are disabled who will require full-time care. I think we also had a number of citizens who came in and testified, some with their children who require full-time care. At the time, though, of course, I was concerned about the revenue impact. The initial revenue impact we had on this from Legislative Revenue Office was $16 million in the 2001-03 biennium, the coming biennium, and roughly $16 million in the succeeding biennium, the 2003-05 biennium. That initial bill had a $60,000 income threshold limit. So what I did is I worked with Ed Waters to find a way in which we can try to manage this revenue impact in a more responsible way, but still provide this relief to lower-income families that I think is very much needed. I think it's important, of course, that we remember we're talking about people that require basic care in terms of basic daily functions. And the incentive here, the purpose here is to try to give family members some additional support to make the decision to stay home and provide that that daily care and that daily support that family members need. So what we did to the dash one amendments, number one, we waited till the 2003-2005 biennium to put this policy into effect. We lowered the credit to $1,000 and we lowered the income threshold to $40,000. And in 2005-2007, we simply stepped up the credit to $1,500, maintaining the $40,000 income threshold. But as you can also see, we reduced the credit or 50 cents for each dollar of taxable income above the threshold amount. The purpose for that is I didn't want to have a situation where someone's at $40,500 unless they lose the credit. They would lose 50 cents on the dollar as the income increases. And I think we also indexed this for inflation, didn't we, Ed?
Yeah.
The $40,000 we indexed for inflation.
It is.
So it doesn't lose value over time. So those are the changes, and of course you can see the revenue impact in the coming biennium drops from $16 million to zero. In the succeeding biennium, it drops from $16 million to $9 million. And then in the following biennium, three biennium down the road, it drops from, presumably it would have been about $16 million down to about $11,700,000.
Okay. And we do have a witness on this bill. It's Deborah Buchanan from the Department of Revenue. Just looking at the witness list, we had, to remind everybody, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 witnesses all testifying in favor of this bill last hearing. Deborah, you're here to testify neutrally.
Yes, sir. Chairman Shadley, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue, and really just a very minor technical point. The Dash One Amendment on line 4 and line 28 both use the phrase taxable income. And while under Oregon law,
I'm sorry, line what?
Line 4.
Of what page?
Page 2.
Oh, page 2.
I beg your pardon. And line 28 of page 2.
Okay.
Under Oregon law, adjusted gross income for Oregon is the same amount as federal adjusted gross income. Most of the time, you'll have two different amounts for taxable income for Oregon and for federal. So it would be a great help to us if you specified whether you wanted Oregon taxable income or federal taxable income at that threshold.
Mm-hmm.
Or whether you would prefer adjusted gross income.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Deb brings up a good point. I was talking with Dexter after I had a look at the amendments, and he said that it's intended in this construct that that language would refer to federal taxable income. Federal taxable income is defined as adjusted gross income minus deductions, federal deductions minus federal exemption amount. So, in fact, this $40,000 taxable income threshold could be more like $60,000-$70,000 adjusted gross income threshold for taxpayers with significant deductions and exemptions.
And Mr. Chair?
Representative Carlson.
What type of income was used to come up with these revenue impact figures?
These are based on adjusted gross income, so in fact, they may understate the revenue impact of this amendment with the federal taxable income threshold in there as it is now. I didn't catch it in time to really have a look at it and try to redo it.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Witt.
Ed, you're saying you thought you were working off adjusted gross income.
That's correct.
Before deductions.
That's correct.
That certainly was my understanding, Mr. Chairman. And I was looking at this to apply to taxable income $40,000, sure. not after all of your deductions. What you're left with is $40,000.
Yeah. So then, Deborah, what's the language, or Ed, the language we need? We could probably do this conceptually, I would think.
Rather than taxable income, it would be adjusted gross income.
We don't need to say federal adjusted gross, but adjusted gross income.
Same in Oregon.
Under Oregon law, Oregon adjusted gross income is the same amount as federal adjusted gross income.
Adjusted gross income. That would be on line. Oops. That would be on line 4.
7.
And on line 28.
Are you right? Line 7 also.
Line 7 too, Mr. Chairman. Page 2.
Deborah, you agree with that?
Yes, sir. Line 7 as well.
Anything else, Deborah?
No, sir.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2332 and open the work session. Representative Witt?
Mr. Chairman, do you have to move for rule suspension to do the conceptual amendment?
Yes. Yes. Do you move? Representative Witt moves for unanimous consent that we suspend the rules to allow for a conceptual amendment to the dash one amendments. Is there any objection? Okay, none. We are in rule suspension.
And Mr. Chairman?
Representative Witt?
I move that we conceptually amend the dash one amendments to House Bill 2332 on page 2, line 4, to remove the word taxable and insert the words adjusted gross.
Okay.
And on line 7, page 2, remove the word taxable and insert the words adjusted gross. And on line 28, page 2, remove the word taxable and insert the words adjusted gross.
Okay, Representative Witt moves that we conceptually amend the dash one amendments on line 4 by deleting the word taxable and inserting adjustable gross. On line 7, deleting the word taxable and inserting adjusted gross. And on line 28, deleting the word taxable and inserting adjusted gross. Is there any discussion on that proposed conceptual amendment? Any objection? Okay, the dash ones are conceptually amended.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Witt?
I move the dash one amendments as they've been conceptually amended to House Bill 2332.
Representative Witt moves the dash one amendments as conceptually amended to House Bill 2332. Is there any discussion on that motion? Any objection? Representative Witt.
Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill 2332 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Witt moves House Bill 2332 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on that motion?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Beck.
I have a kind of a question to Representative Witt on this sort of relates to the previous bill we just passed. In this bill, there's an income test or threshold. I'm wondering, you know, just sort of a macro policy question. Why in this bill is there an income threshold, but on the long-term care, I mean, I think I could answer that question myself, it's sort of obvious, but just why wouldn't we have, say, on the previous bill, have put in an income threshold for long-term care insurance? We do it here. I think it's very clear. I think it's good policy, but why not in the other one?
Well, I think the reason for doing it, Representative, in 2332, the bill we're considering now, is fairly obvious,
right,
in the sense that people with higher incomes, even $60,000, $70,000, are in a better position, of course, to provide the immediate need with some outside support to the bill. And, of course, I'm also trying to be very conscious of the revenue impact. The long-term care insurance policy, though, is something that, and I think Representative Bates alluded to this, and I think the chair did as well, that a lot of people run into the situation where they deplete their assets, even people that had a reasonable estate to begin with, they deplete their assets when they get into a situation where they have a long-term care need. In fact, my mother's required 24-hour care now for the last year and a half. I mean, there's literally someone in our house 24 hours a day. And that becomes very draining of an estate very quickly. So what I'm trying to do there is I'm trying to be sensitive to that fact and really creating some additional support for all people to afford and to buy a long-term care policy so they don't run into that situation, which over a long period of time can really drain assets. I think it's a little bit different policy consideration.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Yes. Representative Beck.
Looking down the legislature next biennium when all these, someone has to reconcile all of these good idea tax cuts, tax credits that we'll be funding, and I think we have passed many of them which are good public policy, and we keep putting them off, and I think we're going to, assuming they pass, they all pass this session in the Senate and governor signs them, there's going to be yet another little hole to dig out of next session without any new revenues to make up for it all.
Well, I will say, and I appreciate that concern. I will say, though, trying to give you some comfort, maybe Paul sometime can bring us up to date on our revenue impact, that is, the bills that we've passed with revenue impacts. And I think you would be surprised, we all would be surprised to see how really conservative this committee has been in terms of creating holes in the budget. These are these happen to come together, and it looks like a lot in context, considering we've been at this for these 18 or 19 weeks. We've been, I think, pretty responsible in terms of creating holes, either in the current biennium or even in the future. And you know, I'm not unrealistic about the prospect of all of these getting through. So I don't mind front-end loading some of these, understanding that some of these may not get through on the Senate side. But even at that, I was impressed in looking at the list and how really, I think, responsible we've been in not creating too many of the goals. Representative Bates.
Just along that line, you know, we look at an overall $12 or $13 billion budget.
Right.
A 1% change in budget is $120 million.
Right.
And I haven't gone back and added up what we've done here, what damage we've done. I suppose the longer we stay, the more damage we do. But you know, you look at this, I don't think we're probably anywhere near even 1%.
Mm-hmm.
If I haven't even looked, I haven't actually added it up yet. So I agree with you. We've been conservative.
We have 110 on the. Right. Well, like I say, we're not guaranteed that all these are going to get through.
Right.
So.
Well, it's just,
and there's no guarantee on that either.
Yeah, I think these are all great policy. If we get told constantly when we need $1 million for scholarships or we need appropriations for little programs here and there, we're prohibited down in Ways and Means from getting there on certain other meritorious proposals. It's more of just a comment, and I think this is with a state with a relatively high income tax and no property tax to speak of anymore to create incentives off of, I think this is a perfectly fine path to go. I guess I wish we, one reflection I will certainly have about this session when it's all said and done is that we do the way in which we put a lot of these things off and not have the wherewithal politically, or, and I don't mean this committee obviously, but just collectively to make these tough decisions and create the revenue or somehow to allow these good incentives to stay in place in the context of current or new revenues. And it just, I worry that down the road we're asking other people to make some, being forced to make some tough financial decisions. Now maybe $100 million next session won't seem like anything and this will just be a blip on the screen, but...
You know, if you take the longer term, we may be saving future Ways and Means committees from making as tough decisions as they're having to now. I think what we're looking at both in this bill and the long-term care insurance bill are ways to leverage dollars through tax incentives to perhaps reduce the demand on direct services that the state has to provide. So I'm cognizant of that as well. Representative Lynch?
Yeah, I would just point out, Mr. Chairman, to Representative Beck, this is not unusual about this session. I suspect this has been going on forever. The immediate needs for next biennium are pretty immediate. You know, we don't have a real big opportunity. We have a few opportunities. We have things like the kicker that we can talk about, and we've got tobacco funds, and we have a few things that we can consider, but we don't have a whole lot of tools in terms of responding to those needs, other than pretty much with those revenues that are there. So it's pretty logical to not apply some of these credits that are meritorious to the immediate coming biennium. But when you talk about 3 or 5 years down the road, you know, there's a lot of things that can happen. There's lots of opportunities to adjust revenues in other ways or tax credits that maybe don't make sense anymore in other ways to try to adjust policy in a way that's appropriate. But what's important to me in this particular bill is we're talking about here, first of all, relatively low-income people. We're talking about where they have family members that require some really basic support and basic need, and we're trying to provide a little additional support to those families to be able to take care of their own family members who've got some kind of a severe disability. But to me, this is a fundamental fairness policy, and we have to try to work through it. And these folks are going to have to wait 2 years to get the benefit of this policy should this bill become law, but it's something that gives the legislature certainly time in the next biennium to respond to these kinds of changes in a responsible way to make sure that revenues are there to meet essential government needs.
And I like the way these bills, some of these things we've done, play together. You can have a family that, a working family that can take advantage of the working family child care tax credit with an elder member or a disabled member of the family living with them and take advantage of this. And we've done some good things.
Right. I agree.
It sounds like we're talking at the committee dinner. We're not. We're still in hearing our work session on the bill. I guess we're ready for the roll call. This is on the motion to send the amended House Bill 2332 to the floor of the DuPass recommendation. Joan.
Representative
Fay.
Aye.
Fast.
Aye.
Brown.
Aye.
Taft.
Aye.
William.
Aye.
Leah.
Aye.
Vice Chair Carlson.
Aye.
Excuse
me.
Aye. Okay. House Bill 2280. It goes to the floor with a DuPass recommendation. Representative Witt, I'm going to make you share the glory in this. Who wants to carry this? Anybody else want to carry this?
Okay.
Let me see. Representative Carlson, you carried a couple on the floor yesterday.
Go ahead.
Ask you want that?
Sure.
Representative Hass. Okay. Do you mind, Representative Wynn?
Oh, that's fine.
Okay.
Fine, Mr. Chair.
That closes our public our work session then on that bill. Paul's distributing to you the total, the running total of general fund revenue impact bills we have. Just for your own information, we don't need to talk about this today, but since we were talking about it and He showed me that he had this,
single cells, didn't I?
Yeah, that's an old phrase.
There you have it.
Yeah.
Okay, I want to go back to work session, to, open a work session on...
Yeah.
And work out...
House Bill...
This is the rest of the stuff.
3057.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
You ready for motion?
Well, I want to, I missed the discussion. Where are we on 3057 as far as the Ways and Means Impact goes? Anybody care to offer a thought on that?
Well, I think that we have a, Chairman, we have a statement from the department, I guess, or is this from LFO?
It's from the department.
From the department to LFO. If you wait 2 days, we'll get one from LFO that looks just like it.
I think it's just, I just can't imagine that this kind of fiscal impact will be remotely the case. I think this program's going to take a while to get up and running, and I think if it is successful in 2 or 3 years, there's going to be a need for some additional FTE at the department to, you know, help facilitate some of these riparian plans. But I guess I disagree with the department in anticipating a huge impact in the next biennium. I think it's going to take a while to get the word out that this program is even available. I think that I just think it will take at least a biennium or two for this thing to really have a significant impact. And I think the department is, as departments often do, try to come forward and see if they can use a little program to either kill or get more positions or kill something they think might be burdensome, but I just don't think this is going to be burdensome anytime soon.
Representative Carlson, please make a motion. But
well, I just wanted to add that we heard testimony. I asked how many property owners were in the program right now outside the Green Growth Boundary, and they said 13. And then I asked Metro, affirmed this in the City of Portland, how many they anticipated would participate in the next couple of years. They said they thought 6 to 8 and properties. And then I asked how many FTE they had right now in the agency. They said they didn't have any FTE dedicated to it, but they estimated maybe 15% of the time of the number of different biologists out in the field, and that they could get that information to us by the end of the day.
Well, I tell you, I'll give the committee two choices. Paul?
I was just going to say, you have Friday is pretty clear in terms of your agenda, so you do have some time there. Come back to this if you prefer.
Yeah, that was going to be Plan B. Plan A, or the options, I guess, not in any hierarchical sense, would be to go ahead and move the bill to the floor of the due pass today with the understanding that I would not sign the committee report until we saw the fiscal and give the city of Portland folks time to work with LFO to reduce the fiscal to a point that we can send it without referral to Ways and Means. And then if it should come back with a higher fiscal than that, I could always bring the bill back and we could refer it to Ways and Means or just set this over to Friday and take it up and deal with it all at one time. I'll take the lead.
I'm inclined to just move it today.
In that case, then I'll just wait to sign the committee referral until we get the fiscal. I don't want this going to the floor with a $250,000 fiscal impact statement and being embarrassed with questions why we didn't send this to Ways and Means. But I'll do that, and then the city can work with LFO to try and knock down that fiscal impact, if that's satisfactory with everybody. Okay, Representative Beck?
I move House Bill 3057 to the floor, the due pass recommendation.
Representative Beck moves House Bill 3057 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? Okay, please call the roll.
Representative
Hay. Aye.
Bass.
Aye.
Brown.
Aye.
Half.
Aye.
William.
Aye.
Rhea.
Aye.
Vice Chair Carlson.
Aye.
Sikori.
Excused.
Chair Shatterly.
Aye. House Bill 3057 goes to the floor of the due pass recommendation, subject to the caveat that I stated with regard to the fiscal impact. We may see it back if there's a problem. With that, I will close the public to the work session on House Bill 3057, and I think we're adjourned. What? Oh.
I'd be happy to do that.
Okay. Oh, and committee, you've got your